In a Washington Times commentary published last October, George Mason University professor of law, Stuart Mallower, wrote, and I quote, "The massacre of Marines in Beirut, while they were performing a peacekeeping role, can call for only one U.S. response, the overwhelming use of military force against the Syrians. Indeed, U.S. foreign policy has taken a more aggressive stance under the Reagan leadership, and today on Frankly Speaking, we're going to talk about the legitimate use of force as an ingredient of diplomacy." With us is Stuart Mallower. Professor Mallower has a doctorate in international affairs from the University of Pennsylvania, as well as a law degree from Cornell, and he has published extensively in the area of international law. Dr. Mallower, you're saying that in some circumstances, the hostage crisis in Iran or the Marine massacre in Beirut, for example, the U.S. has a right to use force. Explain to us what you mean by that.
The United States obviously has many interests abroad, has many allies abroad. When force is used against the United States, either its diplomatic premises or its diplomats or its armed forces, it would seem to me both international law and domestic law allows, in fact requires in some circumstances, the proper use of military force by the United States to protect its interests, but likewise to protect its allies when requested to do so. Legitimate, however, of course, does not only refer to the legal rights. I'm sure various situations, you could say law perhaps does not permit the use of force by the United States, but yet the public at large would say, well, that doesn't make very much sense. I mean, obviously we have interests abroad, and in many instances, obviously, it would seem to me that force would indeed be legitimate, yet sometimes the law may not be so clear on that. And to me, and that's my basic concern in writing that article, that sometimes where obviously its legitimacy allows us to use force, the law is not so clear. My concern is we ought to look at those legal rules in context of the world we live in today and see if we can perhaps fine-tune them to make them relate more to reality rather than just sterile exercises of scholasticism.
You've indicated that the situation today is different from years ago, that it's not the same warfare.
Well, that's true. The Long Commission report issued by the Department of Defense shortly after the bombings of the Marines in Beirut points out that a new form of warfare seems to have taken hold of the Middle East and other parts of the world. They label that state-controlled terrorism. I don't personally think it's so particularly new, but what the Commission's report indicates is that we're not really very adequately geared up to meet that threat. And in part, they use that as almost as an excuse to say, well, that's why we weren't better able to defend our troops.
What is state-controlled terrorism?
All right. The Long Commission report defines state control of terrorism as the use of terrorism by a foreign government, for example, the government of Damascus or the government of Libya or Iran or the Soviet Union. And it's the use of terrorism by those governments for political objectives, foreign policy, or domestic of those foreign governments. It's not the lone gunman that is going out and committing these acts. These are acts that are organized and actually planned, in most instances, by these governments in order to ensure or carry out their national interests. This is substantially different from the type of terrorism the world has seen before. In the 19th century, perhaps we've had some terrorism. In fact, the sea piracy was a form of 19th century terrorism. But in that case, most of those pirates acted individually, although even then there were instances of the Barbary states in North Africa authorizing those types of raids. And indeed, Thomas Jefferson came into office as a pacifist in the early 1800s, ordered the American fleet and various squadrons to wipe out those types of terrorists that preyed on American civilian ships.
All right, how should the U.S. respond to that kind of a situation?
Well, that's precisely, I suppose, the issue the Long Commission had. They said, well, this is a new situation. Now, I don't necessarily agree it's really a new situation, but they argue that, well, the American military is not properly tuned up or geared up to respond to that type of situation in the mid-1980s. I personally find that astonishing. After all, it was terrorists that blew away our embassy in Beirut, terrorists that took over our embassy before that in Iran. How should the United States react to that? Clearly, in my mind, I believe the president, who is the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces, has an obligation under the Constitution to respond effectively. I think international law authorizes those types of actions. My feeling is that the U.S. response to terrorism ought to be a strong, forceful, and forthright response to those actions, and not only necessarily in purely defensive areas, but certainly in preemptive situations. I don't think there's anything in the legal system, domestic or international, that requires us to sit back and wait to become a victim.
For example, Grenada?
Well, I know a lot of lawyers in the law school at George Mason, at many other law schools, point out that they felt that the U.S. action in Grenada violated both international law and constitutional law. Well, I don't agree with that. Perhaps only myself and the Wall Street Journal argues against that, but it seems to me that as a matter of international law, legal rules are being perverted by our adversaries. Now, I don't see anything in the UN Charter or elsewhere that prohibits us from coming to the aid of a country that has requested such aid in order to help them rebut, if you like, military action taken against them, not in the traditional form, but in the form of subversion. Because otherwise, if we don't react, what we are saying is that countries can use subversion and then hide behind the rule of law, and they will know that the United States will not react to that. I think international law does not require us to sit back passively. I think international law does allow us to come to the aid of countries that are faced with that type of subversion. I guess a corollary of that, of course, is that, well, what does the Constitution say about the president's authority? Well, it's pretty clear to me that the Constitution, when it was adopted in 1787 and became effective in 1789, was a reaction against the poor foreign policy, weak foreign policy of the U.S. government under the Articles of Confederation. I think historically, the founders of this republic wanted the president to be able to exercise a forceful foreign policy, upholding our values and our rights of citizens and of the country.
What specific laws are we talking about?
Well, that's, of course, the problem. Up until very recently, there were not very many rules stated as matter of domestic law. Let's look at the constitutional law first, and then we can look at international law. Constitutionally, the president is the commander-in-chief, but the Constitution says very little about his other authorities or powers in this area. It was only in the mid-1970s, 1973, when Congress reasserted itself in the area of foreign affairs as a reaction to the Watergate era in Vietnam, that it enacted the War Powers Resolution. Now, that resolution does restrict, in a sense, the president's authority, but it allows him implicitly to use force, at least up to the period of time stated in that statute, 60 or 90 days. So it's clear to me, at least as a matter of domestic law, that indeed the president does have authority constitutionally and even under the existing statute, although I think the existing statute may create a problem. As a matter of international law, it's fairly clear that the rules of the game are somewhat vague. Most countries point to Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the United Nations Charter, a provision that prohibits the use of force in international relations. And then most other countries will also point to Article 51 that says countries, however, can use force when they are faced with an armed attack. My concern is, what if, for example, in the Grenada situation, the United States was not faced with an armed attack, and indeed Grenada wasn't. But does that mean the United States or the other governments in that region has to sit back and wait for the overthrow of the Grenadian government and the development of that government as a revolutionary entity in their midst? I don't think so. It seems to me that the United Nations Charter was founded upon the basic values of freedom and self-determination. And it's hard for me to see how we can take the position that once the rule of law has been broken by this type of subversion, that our adversaries can hide behind that and preclude us from reacting forcefully.
The president is not the only one who can make these decisions. He has the Congress and the public to account to. What role do they play?
Well, very, very significant roles. The Congress, of course, is the other side of the equation in the constitutional legal debate, if you like, over the use of force. The Constitution gives the Congress the right to declare war. But even in 1787, the right to declare war was not very often observed. Most countries went to war without a formal declaration of war. But nevertheless, as Vietnam has shown us, that Congress has a very, very important part in the conduct of hostilities, certainly over a period of time. They pay for it, and they, of course, can stop paying the bills, which in fact they did in Vietnam and Cambodia. As far as the public is concerned, from a political perspective, presidents, secretaries of defense, secretaries of state would absolutely be silly to undertake a foreign policy without the necessary political consensus, both domestically and internationally. It would seem to me that in the conduct of foreign policy generally, not just in the use of force, we ought to have a domestic consensus developed, and that ought to be reflected in a congressional support of the administration's action. If I have to criticize this administration for anything in foreign affairs, I suppose it's that the administration has not really gone out of its way to develop that consensus.
You are not asking for indiscriminate use of force. You are saying that needs to be thought out. What sort of changes in our laws do we need to do that?
Well, to have those policies as to the use of force thought out, you need just a very competent administration thinking very clearly about the interests of the United States. But once they decide that force is necessary, I think there are changes that need to be made in two fronts. One, as far as the U.S. law is concerned, constitutional law, I would like to see some sort of rethinking of the War Powers Act. It seems to me the problem with that act is that all an adversary has to do is wait it's the 60 or 90 days, and they will outwait the president, and they know, at least from a domestic legal point of view, the president can no longer use force. That seems to be a silly way of doing business. Internationally, I suppose this is my main concern, and I suppose the main conclusion, that we ought to pronounce, the president ought to enunciate clearly as a matter of foreign policy that he believes international law allows the use of American force when those countries, our allies and friends, are being subverted by indirect use of force by other countries. If we make that type of pronouncement, make it very clear that we view ourselves as having a legal right and a legitimate right to use the force, to the use of force in those types of situations, I believe that type of pronouncement, with the change in the constitutional law rules, or more clearly the statutory rules, I think these changes will act as a deterrence to some degree that will, in fact, preclude the necessity of using military force. I mean, after all, diplomacy cannot be that effective, or very effective at all, without having a prerequisite use of force behind it. And if we make it clear to the world that we have the force and we believe we have the legal right to use it, perhaps that will be a deterrence in order to preclude the use of force in international relations. And indeed, that's what President Reagan suggested a few weeks ago in his Soviet-American foreign relations tour, that ideally we would like to move to a world where there will be no force used, and perhaps those small changes in U.S. law and in our foreign policy declarations would add to that outcome.
Thank you, Dr. Malware. This has been Frankly Speaking, a production of George Mason University. Our technician has been Michelle Assane, and I am Penny Goodman. If you have questions about our program or our guest, please call 323-2138. Thank you for listening.